We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the new report from the IMF that says global economic recovery is weakening. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dean Baker, who is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest ebook is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
And today the IMF issued a report on how the global economic recovery is weakening. They added that there's a risk of further deterioration, that the economic outlook had, in fact, was the possibility of getting worse was considerable, and they downgraded global growth for 2013 from to 3.6% from the 3.9% forecast they did in July. How should we react to this? Is this news to you?
Well, it's the recognition by the IMF of these facts is perhaps news to me. I mean, the economy, the world economy, is clearly very weak. And basically, the IMF is acknowledging what I think is just very obviously true. And what was perhaps most striking was, you know, a bit of honesty here that they said this is really very much man-made in the sense that the austerity policies that we're seeing across much of the world, certainly in the Eurozone and the UK, these are a big factor. They said they underestimated the extent to which they would be a drag on growth, and you know. It's good they're pointing that out, and hopefully they'll put more pressure on governments to change those policies.
Well, indeed, the biggest downgrade was to the U.S. economy, which the IMF expects to shrink by 0.4% this year. And that, of course, is the country where the most austerity, the biggest dose of austerity has been meted out. Is this likely to affect the political debate here in the United States in terms of particularly the conservatives in Congress, in the House, who talk about the fiscal cliff, and presumably after this election, the whole idea of the looming deficits will be revisited?
Well, unfortunately, I think it's not going to have a lot of impact. I mean, the IMF, this is true of other international organizations like the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, they have much more influence in other countries. So it wouldn't be uncommon if we were in France or Germany or something, one of the smaller European countries, in Netherlands or Denmark. If the IMF said, you know, here your policy is really bad, you know, a politician might get up there and say that, and it would carry a lot of weight. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to bow down and go, okay, we're going to do that. But that would carry a lot of weight. It's very hard to imagine that President Obama or Governor Romney are going to say, oh, the IMF told us this, that, and that, and people might laugh at them. So it really carries a little weight, maybe, in the sense that, you know, we have kind of these intellectual debates, and we go, look, even the IMF acknowledges this and that. I'm happy to have them on my side in that sense. But unfortunately, I don't really think this is going to have all that much influence.
Well, is this a case, though, that of reality not impinging on ideology? I mean, you have ample evidence of what austerity's done to England, what it's done to Greece and Spain, where there's over 50% youth unemployment. Angela Merkel has got a very chilly welcome in Greece. The people have quite angry, particularly at the German banks who have been made whole at the expense of the Greek people. And it just seems fairly obvious that where austerity's been tried, it's failed, and that, you know, Keynes is still alive.
You would think that, you know, you'd like to think that policies promoting stimulus would have more sway. And again, at least in the U.S., it's a marginal impact, hopefully more of an impact elsewhere. But again, a lot of people don't want to be convinced. You would think in the UK, it's almost just straight textbook. It's perhaps a more arguable point in the Eurozone case, because you do have this issue that, you know, countries can't unilaterally stimulate their economy. In other words, Greece, you know, it needs the permission. Indiana wants to stimulate its economy. Well, Indiana can't spend money. It needs permission from the federal government, essentially. It would have to underwrite it. And that's the way countries, Eurozone countries, the situation they face. But the UK has its own currency. They could just go ahead and run larger deficits. Their interest rate on the debt's extremely low. It's around 1.6%. It's kind of what it is in the U.S. If there were any problem of selling their currency, their bonds on the markets, they could have the Central Bank of England buy it up. There should not be an issue with them stimulating their economy, yet, you know, they have a government that's committed to it. And, you know, just inflicting enormous damage, as you say. I mean, if we had an enemy at war who was doing the same sort of damage as, you know, our leaders are doing to the UK, to the US, to the Eurozone, you know, we'd be up in arms. Everyone would be enlisting at their local draft office, and, you know, we'd be ready to really go at them. But, you know, somehow they put on their coats as economists and they say everything's fine.
So the IMF report on the slowdown in economic recovery globally, of course, cites China, China being the engine of global economic growth, and it's slowing down. It would grow 7.8% this year, down from a previous forecast of 8%, and 8.2% next year, down from 8.5%. Previously estimated, and India is in a similar situation as well. How much is the fact that isn't there a lot of overcapacity in China? Obviously, the European markets are drying up. Is there concern that China, just for domestic political stability, don't they have to? Their economy has to grow. At least that's the way that the Politburo sees it.
Well, It obviously has to grow. I mean, previously, you know, the idea was that to grow 10% rate, and then you had people saying sort of the contradictory thing that they can't maintain that growth rate because they're running out of people migrating from the countryside to the cities. Well, of course, if you're running out of people, then you don't have to grow that fast. You know, the argument was, well, you had to grow that fast to maintain full employment, and, you know, I won't call myself an expert in China, but does stand to reason after a certain point, the rate of flow from the countryside to the city is going to slow. They've had very low population growth over the last decade, so it certainly wouldn't be surprising that, you know, their target rate, what they have to do to maintain something close to, you know, high levels of employment, it would be lower today. So whether 8% will cut it, I can't really say, but it wouldn't surprise me that they could do much better, do it something lower than a 10% rate, which is really extraordinary, especially since they've maintained that for close to three decades now. So I'm not sure that 8% is a disaster. Now, what they do clearly have to do is move towards meeting this more with domestic demand, which in a sense shouldn't really be a problem. Essentially what that means is people have to enjoy higher living standards. So you wouldn't think that one would be that hard to sell. Now, different groups will benefit by that in the sense that there are groups that have, there's industries that are set up to export to the United States, to West Europe, to other countries around the world, and those might not be the same companies that benefit from an increase in domestic demand. So in that sense, you'll have powerful interests who would be unhappy about that. But certainly from the standpoint of the economy as a whole, increasing domestic demand would likely be a good thing. I mean, that would mean rising living standards.
So what explains this emerging spate of China bashing that's going on both in the political campaign, where both the Romney and Obama campaign are accusing each other of being soft on the Chinese, in effect. 60 Minutes just did a report on a Chinese company they suspect of being a stealth operation for espionage. Then the Chinese company argues that they just want to put in cheap broadband in the United States. My understanding is that we need the Chinese to keep buying our treasury bills to finance our deficit on the one hand, but on the other hand, do you think that there's a political price to China bashing?
Well, it's not clear. We actually don't need them to buy our bonds. In fact, President Obama, at least ostensibly, has been asking them not to buy our bonds, because that is, when you hear people saying they manipulate their currency, that's how they do it. They buy our bonds. That's a one and the same act. That's what kind of the absurdity of U.S. politics and economic debates, the way in which they manipulate their currency is by buying U.S. government bonds. So if we're unhappy about them keeping down the value of their currency against the dollar, then we should be unhappy about them buying U.S. government bonds. That is how they do that. So that's more than a little perverse. If they stop buying the bonds, what that would mean is that the dollar would fall against China's currency, our goods would be more competitive there, their goods would be more expensive to people in the United States, which would move us towards more balanced trade. And it's important to understand that it wouldn't just be with China. Other countries target their currency against the Chinese currency. So if it were the case that China's currency would rise, say, 20 or 30% against the dollar, you'd probably see something comparable with the Vietnamese currency, the Indian currency, Cambodian, a whole set of currencies through the region. That's been the past pattern. So that would go a long way towards redressing our imbalance in trade. So I think part of this story is based on real grievances we have in China. Some of them don't bother me at all. I couldn't care less if they're making copies of Microsoft software. That's not something that concerns me. I don't own any stock in Microsoft. It ain't my problem. Others, as I said, the currency issue is more real. But the point is, just as some businesses benefit there from these things, some businesses benefit here. And that's, I think, the reason why we haven't done anything. People, yell at China. It's really not China has so much power in U.S. politics. It's U.S. corporations like Walmart and General Electric that benefit from cheap labor in China that don't want to give that up. They don't want to see everything that we get from China cost 20 or 30% more. So it's, if we want to bash someone there rather than beating up on the Chinese government, I think the more reasonable targets are probably General Electric and Walmart.
So, again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Let's turn to the post-election fiscal cliff that is tied up, of course, in this sequestration vote that was a result of the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party essentially putting the full faith and credit of the United States in jeopardy, having a political tantrum so that they could get their way and essentially carry water for the billionaires who, heavens forbid, the Bush tax cut should end. They went to the mat to stop the Bush tax cut from ending, and thus we got this deal that a lot of people are alarmed about. I spoke with some people recently who said, it's not the end of the world if the defense budget is cut. It'll only go back to what it was in 2007. And frankly, it's almost impossible to cut the defense budget. At any rate, this may be a great opportunity. And likewise, the top tax rate would go back from what it is now, 35%, back to what it was under Clinton at 39%. And that's not the end of the world for the billionaires who've made out so well over the last few decades. So what's your reading on whether or not the sequestration, if it happened, would be a catastrophe?
Well, there's a few things. So the sequestration, certainly the issue of the military budget doesn't bother me. As you say, it's bloated. If it gets cut back some, it's around a 10%, a bit less than 10%. It's about 8% cut. It's hardly a disaster. But the domestic side of the budget is about 10%. We would feel that. But an important point about that, what happens in January, and people are making a big issue, we fought the cliff term is really annoying because it really is not what's going on. It's very little this happens in January, if anything, because it's important to understand what literally happens in January is that we're appropriating less money to be spent beginning January 1st. That has almost nothing to do with how much actually will be spent in the month of January, in the month of February. Those are outlays. Much of that was appropriated last year, this year. So the idea is suddenly we're going to have a huge cut in spending. No, that isn't the case. And particularly if it looks like we're about to negotiate a deal where at least some of that's restored, then there's no reason at all to think there'll be any notable cut in spending come January 1st. On the tax side, important to realize, the tax rates for the top 2% would go back to the Clinton era rates, but they would for everyone else as well. That'd be a big tax increase, and that's being coupled at the same time at the end of the payroll tax deduction. Again, January 1st is irrelevant. When they do it January 1st, and that really doesn't matter if they do it January 10th, 15th, January 20th, even if they got into February, wouldn't be a big deal. But the story of us going into a recession, that assumes that they never fix it. We go all 2013 paying taxes at a higher rate. And given that the economy on the whole is not doing great, if we suddenly saw a big increase in taxes on the order of $500 billion, that would be a hit to the economy. I don't think there's any two ways about it. And I think the story that we go back into a recession, that's very plausible. So getting a deal by January 1st, doesn't matter. You know, it'd probably be nice if we could write down tomorrow, here's what everything's going to look like. But if the price of that were a really bad deal that will extend the Bush tax cuts for another however many years for the rich, I would say that probably isn't worth doing. You know, so it's a negotiating issue. And in the event that President Obama gets reelected, and if he doesn't, it's all kind of moot, I guess, but if he gets reelected, if he were to carry the negotiations into next year, there's not any real bad consequence from that.
Well, Dean Baker, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog, Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about how the Democratic Party in Ohio is suing a mine owner who forced his employees to appear at a Romney rally.
Yeah.